All right. Any questions from last time? We ended up getting through global warming. Any questions from last time? So kind of moving on to another hypothesis that is been put out there. Again, some of like the global warming hypothesis and this hypothesis, trying to, you know, think of things, you know, some of these declines are occurring in very remote areas where seemingly there's very little human influence. And so that, you know, lends some thoughts, some suggestions, some evidence that, you know, things are happening on a large scale. And so global warming, ozone depletion, and certainly we'll talk about another thing, a pathogen that's on a global basis has been impacting amphibians. So anyway, so this research started back in the 80s and really lots of stuff being done in the 90s, primarily by out of Oregon, Oregon State University, or University of Oregon. Oregon State is, yeah. Andy Blostein's done a lot of work. So again, the whole idea, ozone depletion, more UVB radiation coming into the atmosphere, and ultimately, what can that, how can that influence amphibians? Well, there's lots of different research that's showed that depending on the levels of UVB radiation, there can be direct mortality of individuals. It can cause malformations, but probably the most likely thing is with the amounts that are coming through and that are in the atmosphere, decrease hatching success of the eggs. And that's certainly been shown, and it depends on their species-specific differences, and that it depends on a particular enzyme, photolyase, that's in the eggs. If you're a species that has a low amount of that enzyme in your eggs, you have a higher susceptibility of being negatively impacted by UVB radiation. Also, species that lay their eggs near the surface and not submersed or attached to vegetation tend to be impacted most. Again, that's more of a direct contact, a kind of an exposure. Consequence of exposure where you're laying your eggs. The other thing is at higher elevations. Species that tend to be at higher elevations, the concentrations of UVB, the intensity is higher, and hence they're more susceptible. So, I guess nobody's talking about this hypothesis at all. We had it on there, but as another 533 topic, but nobody will be talking about it. Nobody selected it. So, as of right now, nobody's going to talk about it unless Dr. Hooverman wants to talk about it. We can, or we'll just have. I think we currently have one 533 talk that day. We'll just have one. So, yeah.
Is it just on like the metamorphs and tadpoles, or does it actually affect adults as well?
Yeah. So, does it just affect the metamorphs and tadpoles or the eggs? I think that most of this direct mortality stuff, I think that they do have some evidence that the adults, I mean, they can really douse the heck out of them, but as far as the likelihood of that actually killing an adult in the out in the environment is very low. So, yeah, you can certainly nuke a frog, but, you know, the impacts are, the greatest likelihood impacts are on the eggs. Yeah.
So I wonder that when we go to the field trip and then we see the frog die, and how we assume that this was died due to the movie and that this was died in the disease.
Okay, so how do you differentiate between different potential causes? Well, that's where, for ecologists, we don't know. And it's very hard to tell from a gross inspection. Sometimes you can. I mean, there might be some signs and stuff that you see that suggests it died because of A, B, or C. But for the most part, you need to look internally within the animal. And so there are, depending on each of these things, there are different changes to organs or to the skin that would suggest one thing over another. And so ecologists frequently collaborate with veterinary pathologists. So basically, folks that their job is to determine the cause of disease. That's what their interest is. And they often are looking at doing histology, looking at the, you know, looking at the cell structure, et cetera. So, yeah.
So then the frog have the dermal cancer?
They get dermal cancer from UV exposure? Yeah, you know, that's a good question. And I would suspect that the direct mortality that could have happened with an adult would be related to some type of skin cancer, some type of, the alteration of their skin DNA. I don't think that's been documented very often. I really don't know if the thing about amphibians is, for the most part, they're trying to stay out of the sun. And, they need to get wet. And there are certainly some of them bask, and they'll sit in the water and bask. And those are at higher, greater likelihood of exposure than. But the other thing is that most amphibians, the adults, are active at night. So they're subterranean, they're under the water, they're hiding in vegetation during the day. They tend to be more protected than when they're out. But the eggs can be floating around in direct sunlight. So, good questions. Other thoughts or comments? Jason, you have any thoughts? Actually, Blosting's done quite a bit of good work on this, but. In my opinion, W, again, widespread, really driving amphibian declines, probably not. Maybe, number one is high impact. So probably it's not cause of, certainly could act in, probably, let's see, vegetation. I have some synergy going on here. Yeah, could, this and other factors could interact together, And see that as a recurring thing. These all could be, and in fact, it's very likely that at least a couple of these things often are interacting in a population to result in a die-off. Okay. So, next hypothesis. Any other questions? Okay. Acid rain. Decrease in pH as a consequence of emissions of nitrogen oxide, sulfur dioxide, and their oxidation dissolution to acid. So we have, all these chemicals, these compounds coming out, they get into clouds, and then ultimately they rain down, and you have sulfuric acid and things like that that are being deposited, resulting in lower pH. And we're right in an area where that happens a lot. The Great Smoky Mountain National Park is a quote-unquote hot spot for low pH in acid rain. And certainly this could have, widespread implications if it has impact. So what effects do low pH have on amphibians? Well, first of all, most research suggests that pH has to be below 4, so getting pretty darn acidic before it really has negative impacts. It can result in direct mortality of individuals. And again, being most susceptible are going to be your tadpoles, and then the juveniles, and then the adults. Certainly delayed hatching or actually killing the eggs or the embryos in the eggs. Reduced mobility at lower pHs, it can affect the behavior of the animal, which can make them more susceptible to things like predation, and reduce larval growth and size. And all these have been documented and in controlled studies. And if you grow slower, that can be a bad thing, because if your water source dries up and you're not to a point where you can go through metamorphosis, then you might desiccate and die. And even if you do go through metamorphosis at a smaller body size, that can have negative evolutionary contexts. And I think Dr. Huberman's going to talk a little bit about body size at metamorphosis and what that ultimately means and the importance of it. Now, for the most part, pHs at this level, even from acid rain, usually water sources aren't reduced that much. So again, that's why I have this up here as, widespread, but probably not a major factor directly. But again, two things. One thing could be the food web, where you have micro, macro invertebrates that may be impacted, may be more sensitive to changes in pH that that tadpoles may depend on, they may feed on. And then there's, again, synergy. One thing that we're actually interested in looking at in our lab is what are the potential interactions between moderately low pHs, not lethal effects, but sublethal effects, and ultimately how that can maybe increase the probability of you being infected by a pathogen. And so these things, these are real things that could be happening out there. Stress the animal, their immunocompetence drops, and they've indirectly died because of this, but they've directly died because of the pathogen. And so, any questions? We're just kind of teasing these things out. And initially, when all these hypotheses came out, y'all, it literally was, there were labs around the country that wanted to explain why amphibians were declining. And they came up with their hypothesis, and they focused on that. And that was it. It was acid rain, or it was global warming, and that's it, and that's the only thing. But in reality, we are now recognizing that is not probably the situation. So now we're starting to do some research where we're trying to look at the impacts of multiple stressors on an organism. Okay, so any other any thoughts, questions? That's a tiger salamander larvae right there in Texas. Good size one there. Okay, now we have, I think, four pathogens we'll talk about. The first is the chytrid fungus, W1. Widespread and definitely a major impact. Yeah, I may have changed that. I don't know. Those were those were older slides. This is a fungus, there's no doubt this has resulted in extinction of amphibians and large scale die-offs. You don't need to remember all this. This is just some of the taxonomy, etc. It does exist throughout the globe, and it is most of the die-offs that have occurred in the tropics, first of all, and they've occurred at high elevation. We have had some die-offs in the United States over in the Rocky Mountains. They're all at high elevation, though. Or I should say the Rocky Mountain Range. This fungus colonizes the keratinized epidermal cells. And so in tadpoles, it colonizes around the oral disc and the beak of the tadpole, and that's it. And it's not really pathogenic to tadpoles. It can cause some mouth deformities, but they usually are just fine and they survive. As soon as they go through metamorphosis, though, boom, I mean, they die very quickly as keratin develops within the epidermal cells. And adults, this is where it ends up. Basically, what it does is it results in what's called epidermal hyperplasia, which is the production of more and more cells. And the skin gets very, 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 very thick. And ultimately, as you can imagine, in the skin, you'll see it sloughing off. What happens is that impacts cutaneous respiration, and it also impacts osmoregulation. And those things can interact together, ultimately result in toxins being built up, for example, in the amphibian dying. And pretty much, you know, it's very pathogenic. You know, 50 to 100% mortality. And the thing that we don't really understand is when it isn't very pathogenic even in the tropics at lower elevation. And it's not very pathogenic at all to our species that we have here in the United States. And the question is, you know, why is it pathogenic towards some things and not other things? Is it related to the species that it's impacting, or is it related to the environmental conditions surrounding those species? And so it seems, okay, it's at higher elevation. So what's at higher elevation? Well, it's colder. This particular pathogen, you can kill it if the amphibian is warmed up to 37 degrees Celsius, which is pretty darn warm. Actually, the amphibian itself doesn't really need to be warmed up that much, but it does better. This pathogen does better in cooler environments. Well, then you would think that it would just do wonderful here in the United States, right? We're a heck of a lot cooler. So it can't be completely related to just temperature alone. Other thing, there is a hypothesis out there that actually Chytrid's already moved through our populations, and there were massive die-offs that happened, and we didn't even recognize it back in the early 1900s. It's believed that one of the hypotheses that exists out there is called the Out of Africa hypothesis. And I don't want to go too much into it because we have a speaker that'll be coming in talking about the different hypotheses, but the thought is that the African clawed frog, Xenopus, was in the release of it. They were brought over in the early 1900s, and they were used for lab experiments, and some of those individuals have been released into ponds, and there are little Xenopus populations all over the United States. So this species can be infected with chytrid, and it's not that big of a deal. And so that's one of the thoughts, is that maybe die-offs occurred and nobody really recognized that they were occurring, and so now what we have are basically resistant species that are out there and whatever. There's lots of folks that have different ideas about how it got here and how it's being transmitted and what are the factors. And the reality of it is there's not a really one good explanation that we know of, and still trying to kind of figure it out. So regardless, highly pathogenic organism. Okay, and it is, there, you know, two, a pathogen can actually function in two different ways. It can be called it can be an introduced pathogen, and, or an endemic pathogen, so one that, you know, the amphibians are used to. And this one is certainly acting with certain species like it is an introduced pathogen, because it's just completely killing everything. So the other thought is, there's another group, a school thought, is that it's an endemic pathogen, and there's something going on with the environment that's, you know, impacting the amphibians, but reducing their immunocompetence, making them more susceptible. In my opinion, I don't think that's probably the case. I think it's introduced. There's another pathogen that we'll talk about, which is very likely endemic. In fact, amphibians are infected with it all the time, but die-offs occur, and we've connected it with when they're stressed, at least in most of the cases. All right, so let's look at Kittredge distribution. You can see it's pretty much has global distribution, as I've already mentioned. Let's see, the red circles are wild populations, the yellow circles are captive populations, but this is just isolated, okay? It doesn't mean that there's been die-offs occurring. So we've actually documented it in, this is a little, this is 2004, and this is a higher number now, it's closer to like 18 species or something of amphibians in North America. But as you notice, let's see here. Yeah, I'll talk about it. There's only three species that we really have definitive evidence that declines have occurred because of it. I've already mentioned before about 120 species of amphibians that we know of have gone extinct since 1980. One third of those actually have been attributed to Kittredge, have been a consequence of Kittredge. And these tend to be species that, again, were never very abundant. They were, you know, had high endemism. They were, you know, very localized, and it came through and boom, and that was it. They're gone.
There's none in Asia?
That's a good point. There's none over here, right, in Asia. No, I wouldn't say that. It's probably, we just haven't looked over there. I don't think there's been a whole lot of testing. Lots of Australia has really been devastated by this pathogen. They've lost a lot of species because of it. And again, you know, here, 10 species of Kittredge. When Roberto comes here, he'll tell you probably he knows of 50 species that have been impacted. So again, these numbers here are exceedingly low to reality. All right, any questions? Oh, okay, yeah, so what about the United States? Well, I'm going to share with you one species that we are pretty sure has had experienced population declines because of Kittredge, the mountain yellow-legged frog, and in the Sierra Nevadas. Again, high elevation species. It has been, again, die-offs have occurred. They've sent them to the pathologist, and it's been determined indeed the etiologic agent of this die-off is Kittredge. There is definitive evidence. Two other species are the boreal toad and the Wyoming toad. They do have some evidence that die-offs have occurred. Again, these are federally listed species. And they were really never very common. There are a few other species that die-offs have been suspected, the Chiricahua leopard frog and the California red-legged frog. There also are reports of northern and the southern leopard frogs. I don't believe this, that it's resulted in die-offs of these. Although there are a couple of cases out of the National Wildlife Health Lab that at least they called it dying from Kittredge. They saw Kittredge was infected with Kittredge, and so I don't really hold this with too much weight. The evidence that's out there is possibly the Chiricahua leopard frog, and I think there's less evidence for the red-legged frog, California red-legged frog. This population has been declining quite a bit, but because of other factors, mostly habitat loss. Yeah.
How widespread is Kittredge in the United States? Is it all over the place?
Yeah, so is Kittredge all over the place? Well, that's a great question. And what are my thoughts of it? No, it isn't everywhere, because we've been testing for it in animals that we've collected. There have been folks that have been testing for Kittredge up in the Smokies, and they haven't documented any salamander populations. They have documented it at Cades Cove in a couple of the anurans. When you do broad-scale surveillance, they've documented Kittredge in South Carolina. They've documented it in a few bullfrogs down in Georgia, but it's not that prevalent for whatever reasons. Okay. I don't know why that's the case. It's just a little weird, you know. These will be, you know, good questions to kind of ask Roberto when he gets here too, because he's really up on the literature, but I think he's going to have the same response as I do, because I think people are still puzzled about why it occurs, where it occurs, and what makes it highly, you know, pathogenic in certain areas and not others, in certain species. And so at least the prudent scientist will be very hesitant to say, yeah, this is the case. There are certainly some folks out there going, oh, it's this, you know. But let's see if I didn't have anything else to dissolve in there. Any other questions? Do you have any comments? This will be, if anybody goes down to Southeastern Park meeting with us, this will have a little bit of discussion going on. There's some folks that study chytrid that'll be there. There's going to be a talk or two on it. On Saturday, there is a disease task force that will be talking about pathogens and their relevance and their importance with respect to die-offs. Myself and Dr. Deborah Miller, who's going to come and give a guest lecture here, we're co-chairs of that task force. And it'll be kind of interesting because I don't think chytrid's that important in the United States. And in fact, I'm talking at SE Park about the next pathogen that I think is important. So we'll have some good discussions at the very least, because folks that study chytrid don't think the next pathogen is very important. And I think it is. Localized L1. And I have localized here because it impacts on a local level, because generally stressors are probably driving the emergence of this pathogen. And so it depends on what's happening at the local site level. But because this pathogen, particularly, everything is infected with it. I mean, it's out there in the environment. When things get infected quite frequently, it can have very broad-scale implications, widespread implications. And this virus it's like probably chytrid. It's everywhere, maybe even more so. I mean, it's an iridovirus, family Iridoviridae. The genus is rhinovirus, and there are several different types. What's called the type species is frog virus 3, and it's been classified as there's about 10 different strains of it, or 10 different types of it. And we really don't even understand the molecular biology of the strains of this virus at this point, if they're all the same or if they're really different. So this is a double-stranded DNA virus. It's a large virus. It's only 3 times smaller than a bacteria. It's pretty darn big for a virus. It has an icosahedral shape, which means it's 20-sided. Kind of looks like a big old kind of hexagon type thing. And I don't know if I think I have a picture on the next one. There have been cases that we know of that folks have reported on in Australia, the United States, and Costa Rica. Symptoms. These are gross symptoms that you might see of an infected individual. You can have dermal ulcerations, what's called petechial hemorrhaging. You can have systemic hemorrhaging inside the body, and edema, swelling. This pathogen, that's not a very good picture, but this pathogen seems to really focus on, and for some reason, recognize the kidney and the liver cells. And so it infects there, and the hemorrhaging that often occurs, the hemorrhaging can occur within the organs itself, or again within the skin. But what it can do, what typically the cause of death is those particular organs. It kills the cells, and you have more and more dying off of the cells, which is called necrosis, and ultimately the organ fails. And so it takes about, after the pathogen enters the body, it takes about 2 weeks really to build up good viral loads to become pathogenic. And at that point, then die-offs can occur very quickly. Most of the cases of emergence and die-offs of this have been associated with some type of stressor, either a natural stressor or a human anthropogenic stressor. Die-offs, natural stressors could occur, could be population density, which works in two ways, creates competition for food resources, less resources for each individual, stressing individuals. It also increases the probability of transmission from individual to individual. As far as how these things are infected, they can be infected by basically ingesting the water. The viral particles can float around the water, they can ingest it. Most commonly, and probably in a very effective way of transmission, is when a tadpole dies from this, tadpoles are scavengers. They'll eat other tadpoles, and you can become infected very quickly by eating an infected dead individual. This is affecting the larval stage. Okay, remember, chytrid really isn't affecting the larvae. Rhinovirus is affecting the larvae, and it doesn't seem to have too many negative impacts. If you survive through it as a tadpole, then you'll probably be okay. The point in development when they have the greatest likelihood of dying is during metamorphosis, because immunocompetence drops at that point. I guess I shouldn't talk too much. I forgot I got a whole lecture on rhinovirus later on in the semester, but that's just a little bit of details on this. So again, natural stressors, population density, development, and then water temperature. Immunocompetence in tadpoles and in adults drops as ambient temperature, the surrounding temperature, decreases. Human stressors are probably any stressors, but at least ones we've connected die-offs to, most of them have been associated with cattle ponds. Very first one that was ever reported out in Arizona was associated with cattle ponds. And then we've documented very high prevalence of this pathogen in ponds for cattle. There's some evidence, controlled research, that pesticides can increase probability of an infection. And we're starting to do some controlled research and looking at other types of stressors. So. Certainly pH could be a thing too. Anything that can ultimately stress that organism. Now, how important is this? I'm going to have it at SE Park, and I'm probably going to get tomatoes thrown at me. This is an illustration of a comparison between the number of cases that have been, number of cases of die-offs that have been associated with rhinovirus compared to chytrid. We already talked about basically three cases where chytrid. Okay, the Wyoming toad, the boreal toad, and then the yellow-legged frog. In comparison, these are die-offs, y'all. Okay, these are die-offs that have occurred that folks have actually recognized and sent in the animals, and then they were tested. So It's been found to cause die-offs in 12 states, 12 species, compared to 3 species in 3 states with chytrid. And then also up here in Canada. It's a recent die-off case in 2005. ARMI is the Amphibian Research and Monitoring Initiative. They had a report in 2006, and they reported of the die-offs in the United States, 43% are responsible. Ronavirus is responsible for them, 16% chytrid, and 10% protozoan. All right. Now, after I've said all this, I want to read something from their report, which goes through and it says, oh, about 43% of die-offs were due to viral infections, 16 to unique fungal infections, and not all those were chytrid by any means. 10% were due to protozoans or protozoan-like organisms, 6% were due to physical trauma like predation or inclement weather, and 2 to 5% were suspected poisonings or chemicals. All right. Although viral infections are by far the most common cause of massive die-offs in amphibians, virus-caused die-offs usually occur in widespread and abundant species and really seldom affect declining or threatened or endangered species. And I'll tell you what, that sentence has been put in about every damn chytrid paper that exists that where they want to try to sell chytrid. So I'm kind of curious how this pathogen figures out, oh, you're endangered and threatened, so I'm not going to infect you. The point is that this thing affects common species. If it's affecting common species, it's certainly affecting uncommon species. Common species are easy to see a die-off because there are a bunch of them. And it may not be the demise of the green frog and it's going to just go extinct, but there are other species that are coexisting with these common species. In fact, these species, such as the green frog and the bullfrog, may be important reservoirs for the pathogen and keep it going, particularly because their tadpoles can overwinter and they can always keep it within a system. So it kind of just irks me a little. And again, it'll create some good discussion, I think, when we are down in Athens. And this is what I claim and written, and folks may disagree with me, I'm sure there are some, that rhinovirus represents the greatest threat to the loss of amphibian biodiversity in at least the United States, and certainly probably beyond our borders. And again, it's particularly because more and more and more systems are being impacted by humans. And this particular pathogen really seems to be emerging in the presence of stressors, anthropogenic stressors. So that's my thought on it. Anybody have any thoughts? We really don't know. We're just starting to learn about these different pathogens, well, at least this particular pathogen. I will make note that the first case of rhinovirus that was reported on was in 1996, published, I think, in 1997. Ironically, the same time, that's when chytrid was documented. And chytrid has taken the spotlight with respect to amphibian declines globally. There's been a lot of good justification for trying to figure out chytrid. But one other interesting thing, and I think from a conservation standpoint, what makes this something worth looking at, is that this pathogen seems to be emerging because of humans. That means that we can have an impact on reducing the emergence and the spread and the prevalence of this pathogen by reducing our impacts and by implementing some type of conservation strategy. With chytrid, they've been studying it millions and millions, and probably it's near probably billions now. They've been studying this thing for 10 years, and they still don't even know what to do. So, all right. Any thoughts? What about rotavirus in Tennessee? It was documented, it's been documented up in the Smokies. In 1999 were the first reports. Let's see, pickerel frog, spotted salamander, wood frog, eastern red-spotted newt, marbled salamander. And these are all in Cades Cove, these die-offs. Then 2006, as you can't see in the bottom, it says Cumberland Plateau. We did some work over there. We found that it was very common in American bullfrogs and green frogs. And last year when we did our field trip, and we're going to do it again this year, we actually tested the individuals that we were capturing, the different lungless salamanders. We caught 10 different species, and 56 of 69 of those individuals, that's around 80%, y'all, were infected with rotavirus. So it's out there. We don't know the health of those individuals. I'll tell you this, that is very, very, very high. 80% prevalence is at a point where that's only really seen when populations are experiencing die-offs. But we didn't collect any to look at health assessments. We didn't see any dead individuals out there. So I've shared this information just recently with the park, and they're interested in looking at it a little bit more detail. So we'll be testing individuals that we collect this year. We might actually even collect a few and bring them back. Yeah.
Would there be enough stress in the park to cause die-offs?
Yeah, so that's a good question. What might be resulting in an emergence of this pathogen? And so an obvious hypothesis would be pH, you know. And do you see a higher prevalence, higher die-offs associated with lower pH? And they've actually, not too long ago, just recently mapped all of the pH gradients through the park. So it kind of sets up an opportunity to potentially look at some future hypotheses, questions, and things like that. Any questions? Good. Okay. Again, I won't go into this too much, but I will say that we did document it on the Cumberland Plateau and bullfrog tadpoles and green frog tadpoles. Decent, you know, prevalent at 30% or so rate. This is real interesting, though, with green frogs. They were 3.9 times more likely to be infected with rotavirus in cattle access ponds. And we'll get into more details about this later on, so I'm not going to spend too much time on that. All right. This is a pathogen, Areomonas hydrophila, that was originally they attributed die-offs originally to, I guess the best way to put it, early 1990s. Everything was dying because of Areomonas. Well, this Areomonas is very, very common bacteria. It's everywhere. It's in the water and everything. Areomonas lives symbiotically with tadpoles. Okay? Well, when amphibians were dying, they noticed that there's Areomonas in it, and that was, it has been shown to, you know, basically, at least in humans, if you ingest Areomonas hydrophila, you can get gastroenteritis, you can get blood poisoning from it. You actually, if you get a cut in your hand and Areomonas gets in it, it can cause, you know, serious issues. Again, septicemia. There are cases where folks have had to have, they call it a fisherman's hook disease, because fishermen sometimes get it because they'll have a puncture and that bacteria will get in there. And there's been cases where folks have had to have limbs amputated because they let it go too long. So, you know, this pathogen is at least what folks have called associated with what's called red leg disease, because there's hemorrhaging that occurs in the pelvic region. Now we're not quite so sure if it really is this bacteria, or if it's really rotavirus and this bacteria is just present, or because rotavirus is having a negative impact on it, it begins to proliferate within the animal. And it may act as some type of secondary invader that contributes ultimately to an individual experiencing mortality. So we really don't know the potential role of Aeromonas with respect to die-offs, but it's probably very likely secondary to viral or fungal infections. Okay. Any questions? All right. All right. The last pathogen that has been not really too much associated with die-offs, but certainly could be with the population. I'll let Jason go ahead, and since you've studied this, how do you? I've heard this pronounced several different ways. Ribeirorhia. Yeah. There you go. Ribeirorhia. That's basically, I think, the what I've heard before too. Ribeirorhia. At any rate, this is a real interesting pathogen, and probably Nathan will talk a little bit about it because it is one of the causes of amphibian malformations. And what happens is you have these, it's a worm, okay, that basically it's living within within water birds, adult birds like water birds like herons and stuff and egrets. And the adult trematode releases, they sexually reproduce, they release fertilized eggs into the water. Well, they release them and then it's defecated into the water. Those hatch into Myriacidium, and those end up insisting within pond snails. They go through a development within the pond snails. They end up either burrowing out or being defecated out into these mobile cicaria, which then swim around and they find a tadpole, and they typically insist right around the vent. And they, once they get within the tadpole, then they create what's called a metasicarial cyst, which is often around the developing limb buds. And as the limbs are trying to develop, that cyst actually prevents normal development. It can cause split limbs. It can prevent actual, if there's enough of those cysts around a limb, it can completely inhibit the development. So you'll just get a frog with only maybe one hind limb. So lots of things can happen. So direct effects really are ultimately probably malformations. The interesting thing is, well, that seems like a crazy life history cycle. You know, why would you be an effective parasite if you are killing your host ultimately or reducing the chance of it surviving? And the hypothesis that's been thrown out there is that basically a malformed frog has a greater probability of being predated by, again, amphibian-eating birds. And so then the cycle starts all over again. Once that individual's ingested, the metasicarial cyst actually then can develops into an adult trematode. Any questions? How are we doing on time? Okay, good. And I'll leave the rest of the stuff for Nathan to talk about. Okay. So this is actually out of a report by the Global Amphibian Assessment, and attributing basically numbers of species that have experienced some declines, with the red being threatened species and other ones being non-threatened species. And you can see, I mean, the biggest thing to take home here, habitat loss, obviously. And then they have pollution as a second, and I'm assuming that's chemical pollution, and then disease down here, which really may be higher. I don't know. We don't really have a whole lot of information out there, but this is their attempt to try to summarize some declines associated with different factors. But certainly habitat loss. Okay, so this is what most folks call the synergistic hypothesis. You know, these different, you know, factors, anthropogenic factors, maybe not all of these, but they're interacting You may have one or two or a couple of these things, and or maybe just one of them that interacts with a natural stressor such as development or water temperature and makes it really, you know, negatively impact, you know, the eggs or the larvae or the adults. Most of these things are, again, as I've already mentioned, I mean, they really can have negative impacts and frequently are tied to having negative impacts in the aquatic environment. And less on the adults, except for obviously habitat destruction. Although, again, there's some recent research which you'll hear about with respect to chemical sprays and stuff like that, that if amphibians are sprayed with it, can have direct negative impacts. Okay. Questions with that? Okay, so it's a lot of things. Okay. As this is just a kind of a point to tie everything back to, again, thinking about amphibians on a landscape, and you know, if you have a population, and think of a population as actually being a species going extinct, in order for that species, that's called a local population extinction. Okay, maybe some of the other species that are there, they don't go extinct. But the only way that, you know, if you think about it on a landscape level, you know, and you have only so many gray tree frogs out there, and all of a sudden the individuals here, they're not very common, they go extinct. Well, the only way they're going to get there, again, is through some type of dispersal event. So as these things happen more and more across the landscape, you end up just having a few populations out there. So you have these local populations going extinct, and ultimately you're set up where you may only have a few populations that are out there, and then certainly some type of event could occur here that results in that population going extinct, and then the potential source of any last remaining individuals could be gone, and that's ultimately how you use extinction. So, you know, it's important, and we'll talk about this, the spatial interaction, distribution, and stuff, and just because you have some common species out there, we need to think about the uncommon species and how those things are affecting those individuals, because they have the greatest likelihood of ultimately being negatively impacted, going through a local extinction, and then potentially a species extinction. And this is just something that I have in here that, you know, is this even important? Why do we give a darn? And, you know, this is something you would be asked, and I'm commonly asked by folks that are just out there, you know, like, why is this even important at all? Who really cares about amphibians? Tell me why this is important. And folks have called amphibians, this is the singularity of amphibians. There's lots of different things that amphibians, why we should be concerned. You know, one, we've already talked about this, they're good ecological indicator species. You know, changes in the ecosystem, they seem to be very sensitive to in the aquatic environment, the terrestrial environment. They're important components of the ecosystem. We're getting into this more and more. They impact trophic structuring of the system. They can be, you know, good detritivores, they can be good herbivores, they can be good omnivores and carnivores. And then there are things that feed on them. And so removing them from the environment can be can really have significant impacts. And Roberto, again, who studies chytrid, will talk some of this about how chytrid has gone through and completely changed the system there. The aquatic system resulted in algal blooms and all these things because the tadpoles had been removed. And the impacts on the predators that are there. There are certainly unknown medicinal uses and other things. We talked about the gastric brood rearing frog as an example that's now extinct. Potential missed human opportunity. Again, down the road at Vanderbilt, Dr. Louise Rollins Smith, she has actually isolated antimicrobial skin peptides from amphibians and has shown that it kills HIV. You know, so there are just, if we just want to think about us, you know, we can use these things, right? They comprise significant biomass. The red-backed salamander in the Appalachians, the biomass of those exceeds the biomass of all other vertebrates put together. That's pretty impressive when we have, if you think about it, when we have black bears running around, they're pretty darn heavy, and deer and things like that. So they're important in the whole ecosystem process. They're very efficient animals with respect to actually taking in resources and converting it into energy that they can use. And they're long-lived, so they're around and they're exposed to these things, stressors all the time, and they can't disperse much. So again, this all ties back also into why they're good ecological indicator species. So, plus some of them are pretty darn cool. And, you know, after all, they were the first terrestrial vertebrates. We should have a little bit of respect for them. And we can learn a lot from these systems and their important components. Highly diverse animals. Okay, that's about it. The last thing here is just some what can you do things. So we've already talked about some of this stuff. Okay. Any questions? All right. Dr. Sandy Echternut will be here on Thursday. And he will be talking. We're really now going to delve into amphibian biology. So we're going to probably have about a month of that going on between Dr. Echternut, myself, and Dr. Hooverman. So he's going to talk about reproductive strategies.